Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some of Canada's top Native leaders are meeting today with the Prime Minister and senior members of his cabinet. While some are calling this high-level meeting a reset to the relationship between government and First Nations, others are skeptical. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
A historic wampum belt is being used today for the first time in centuries, its symbolism to help retie the relationship between First Nations and the British Crown. Aboriginal leaders brought a replica of the 1764 Treaty of Niagara Belt with them for today's meeting. The summit includes hundreds of Canada's First Nations chiefs and leaders, along with the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper. But Harper won't be there all day, so he arranged a meeting last night with about 30 chiefs. Alberta Chief Charles Weaselhead says he knows no big announcements will come today.
About our issues in regards to housing shortages and education and poverty and the standard of living in our communities. But in the long term, this is not going to happen overnight. We need to continue to work and dialogue with the Prime Minister.
Other chiefs say everything is on the table and they too don't expect any big changes right away. But many, such as Stan Lutet of the Mushkagowak Council, say they'll be looking to see what the Prime Minister does in his first meeting with them since he took power in 2006.
We know it will take time, but we're looking for the Prime Minister to give us a message to say, yes, we'll build on the relationship that are there, and we're going to work with you moving forward. That's what we're looking for.
Jobs, education, housing, economic development, and poverty are just a few of the issues on the table. The chiefs say there has to be money quickly for housing and water shortages, those issues that require immediate fixes. Long term, they want more talks with the Prime Minister and senior cabinet leaders, as well as provincial premiers. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
About a year ago, South Dakota's governor established a cabinet post for a Secretary of Tribal Relations. The first person to occupy the post has been confirmed by a Senate committee. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Gary Ellenbolt reports.
South Dakota has 9 tribes, and its population is roughly 8% Native. One of Governor Dennis Stuggard's goals is to improve relations between the tribes and state. Last March, he announced the appointment of J.R. LaPlante as South Dakota's first Secretary of Tribal Relations. LaPlante testified before the Senate State Affairs Committee during his advice and consent hearing Monday.
I observe the tribes to be sovereigns, just as the state of South Dakota is sovereign. And I believe that our future, the strength of our future is to continue to develop and to continue to foster that sovereign-to-sovereign, government-to-government relationship.
The enrolled member of South Dakota Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe was approved on a unanimous committee vote. For National Native News, I'm Gary Ellenbolt.
A Texas tribe has received some restitution from 2 men convicted of bilking tribes out of millions of dollars. The Isleta del Sur Pueblo in El Paso says it's received about $200,000, according to the El Paso Times. The restitution is being paid by disgraced former lobbyist Jack Abramoff and his former business partner Michael Scanlon. They pleaded guilty to charges they bilked Native American clients out of millions of dollars. The tribe hired the pair nearly a decade ago to help reopen a casino. Abramoff released a book last year about corruption in Washington, D.C. He was ordered to pay some of the profits to his victims. During this week in 2009, the State Tribal Collaboration Act was introduced in the New Mexico legislature to improve the government-to-government relationship with the state's 22 tribes. It included appointing a tribal liaison to every cabinet-level agency and requiring the governor to hold an annual summit with tribes. The bill was signed into law less than 2 months later. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
With funding from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Every Alaskan can support causes and organizations they care about when they file for a permanent fund dividend. Use PIT, CLIT, GIVE when filing online for your PFD. With one donation at a time, good things will happen all over Alaska.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 5 minutes after three. My first guest in the studio is not actually in the studio today. She's in Washington, D.C. Capital Steps is going to perform here in Juneau at Centennial Hall Thursday night at 7:30. It's a sold-out show, but I understand there are still some tickets that are available at the door. And with me from Washington, D.C. live, I guess you'd say, is Elaine Newport, who's the producer of Capital Steps.
Hi, that's right. I'm here in Washington, D.C., the source of most of our material, so just trying to keep it fresh here.
So I think your weather is a little better than ours here in Juneau. We've got about 6, 12 inches of snow for you
well,
to fly.
Well, you know, we have politicians with a lot of hot air around here, so it does tend to warm things up. But, you know, you actually have politicians, too, of course, in Juneau, but... here we have Al Gore walking around going, told you so, told you so.
And, of course, you're following him about 6 yards away with your pen and pencil in hand writing satirical numbers. To,
yeah, it's really funny. If there's a hot day, you can almost hear him just saying it, yeah.
So you must be under some terrific time pressure right now since there's a new Republican candidate about every 15 minutes. Does that...
Right, or a new front runner. Yeah, I know it's pretty funny. We had this great Herman Cain song we were very happy with, and you know, because there's been these sexual harassment allegations, and he had his 999 plan. So we wrote Love Potion number 999 for Herman Cain to sing, and then of course he drops out. Sad day for comedy, but we still think we could do the song for a little while.
So it'll probably be part of the shows you do here.
It will be, and it's basically we'll set it up as this is what Herman Cain is going to do next. This is his new product line.
So over the next, let's see, about 2 weeks, 3 weeks here, you're going to be all over Alaska. You're in Juneau Thursday night, Petersburg Tuesday night, and then off to Fairbanks and Kodiak and a couple of shows in Anchorage. Who actually is going to be in the state? Do you know which troop members will be with us?
We do know which troop members are going to be up there. There's a lot of people who wanted to come up. They thought it would be quite an adventure, and it sounds like it is so far with your weather and your beautiful scenery combined.
So,
of course we need to come up every once in a while and thank Alaskans for providing us with you know, so many years, so many fond memories of Sarah Palin.
Well, yes, it's practically a local product.
You know, it was almost like you guys were thinking of the comedians, and you're like, okay, let's elect her, and this will help out. Because, you know, Obama's not that funny. Sarah Palin could help out on that.
Well, but right now you're drawing most of your material from the Republican primaries, with the occasional international incident as well. Do you have a new song on Iran or Iraq?
Well, we have a song about the transition to the new Iraqi government called The Sunny Side of Tikrit. And it's all about this guy who takes a job as the Minister of Tourism in Iraq, and he has to try to get Americans to come there, and, you know, what happens in Fallujah stays in Fallujah, that sort of thing.
I'd ask how you get these ideas, but it's obvious. You're on drugs, right?
That I was not expecting, but it's true that a rhyming dictionary really helps. And you do like the politician's names, like Terry or McCain and all that sort of stuff. And then sometimes something just beautiful happens in the news. You know, the governor of South Carolina says he's hiking the Appalachian Trail and he's really in Argentina. And all of a sudden it all comes together and Don't Cry for Me, Argentina, and you have a new song is born.
And are you a pianist? I mean, do you compose this stuff at the piano? Because you worked with 5 different pianists on the shows, right?
We do. We have some great pianists, and they. I actually was a piano major in college, which is so it's weird that you should ask that, but it's fairly useless in my new life because these are all song parodies. So we take, you know, the original song, and we'll change the words all around, as you know, and. You know, we'll take, you know, how do you solve a problem like Korea instead of how do you solve a problem like Maria, and just go from there.
So when you said your new life, you started out in 1981 as an aide to a senator, right?
Right. I worked for Senator Charles Percy, and I don't know if you remember him, but he was one of the last of those moderate Republicans you read about in the history books. You don't see them anymore. But he... I've kind of considered myself an extreme moderate from there on. I kind of think both sides get ridiculous when they get too far out. So we kind of go after everybody on both sides of the spectrum. And now the Tea Party on the third side of the spectrum, if there is such a thing.
It's kind of like two sides of a square. I'm not sure I can do it. Anyway, so when it now the history of the steps is basically that you guys started out singing this stuff and you were actually afraid to perform, right?
Yeah, we thought we would lose our jobs because we were Senate staffers and we just had our 30-year anniversary. So this was 1981, and somebody said, like, well, why don't you just do a traditional nativity play? And we said, well, where in the Congress are we going to find three wise men or a virgin? So we decided to do these song parodies. And we went after our bosses. It was the early days of Reagan. There were a lot of fun stuff. James Watt, you know, Ed Meese, all those people. We did a song called Mine Every Mountain about James Watt. And we had a great time. And now 30 years later, we're still doing it. And as a matter of fact, to close our show in Juneau on Thursday night, we're going to do a song, which is 30 years of satire in 3 minutes. And we try to go through everything that happened in 3 minutes or less. And people sometimes get injured doing the song.
So when was your coming out? When did you decide that this was more important than being a senatorial aide?
Well, I stayed on the Hill for 7 years and tried to do both the Capitol step and work for a senator. And after a while, they started to notice that I was not showing up most days at my day job, that I was traveling and making fun of the government. So I did decide to just do this full-time and kind of run away and join the circus, if you will.
And you had compatriots in crime at that point who made the same decision about the same time, right?
We did. It was kind of gradual. And we added some, you know, we were working for Republican, but we added some Democrats. We added some House people. And basically our thought was we'll spread the blame around. If we get in trouble, then they'll have to blame both parties and both House and Senate. And, you know, nobody will get in too much trouble by themselves.
So then you eventually appeared in the White House.
We have performed for, I think, five presidents. I don't know. Do you count Hillary? I'm not sure. I can't. Six if you count Hillary.
Okay. But not Obama, right?
But not Obama, no. We performed a lot for George W. Herbert Walker Bush.
Uh-huh.
He was very nice to us. He had us to the White House a lot. But he also had Dana Carvey there. And, you know, he had a great sense of humor.
Have you thought about forming a basketball squad to see if maybe you can get in the back door?
That's true. We could. It would be really funny. We could take over the person who plays Kim Jong-il in our show. We have the shortest woman, you know, who used to play Kim Jong-il. Well, now she can't play him anymore. But we could send her over, and he'd be sure to win.
I love Just Like Kim. It's a fabulous piece.
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's with Kim Jong-il and Kim Jong-un, right?
Yeah. The two Kims.
Right.
Anyway, the way you it's like – all of us, I think, want to say something like you guys sing, and then when you do it, it's like we're standing out here saying, yeah, what she said. Anyway, so will you do any localization kind of stuff when you come to Alaska? Are you going to pick up on our politics up here, or do you stay national?
We're going to stay pretty national. There might be the occasional one-liner we'll throw into something about, you know, ferry service in and out of Juneau being run by the Italian cruise ship captain or something. But, you know, we will basically stick with the national issues because there is so much going on right now.
So if let's assume that there's a total blackout on Republican primaries in the next 2 weeks, what would you turn to? Where would you go? If you couldn't do any more songs about the run-up to the Republican?
You mean, what would happen to all of them? I'm trying to just imagine, because we'll still have Mitt and Newt for sure, I think, for a long time. And Ron Paul is not going anywhere because he's just in there to make noise, right? So we've got those guys, and, you know, we do a lot of songs about other issues, too. We'll do songs about airport security and songs about environmental activism and, you know, health reform, health care reform, all these issues that are kind of hanging in the news all the time. We've got lots of songs about those.
On your website, one of the things that you say is that you won't accept songs from outside. If somebody wants to send you a copy of their latest political satire song, you're not into it.
Do you have one?
No. Hey, maybe. Give me 10 minutes. I'll see what I can do. No, I don't have one, but I noticed that basically you said we make all this stuff up ourselves.
Right, and that's partly because, you know, we were Senate staffers, and we're kind of laughing at ourselves, and the source of our material is, you know, for that reason, we kind of think that gives us a little bit of a shtick that here we were, Hill staffers, we didn't solve any of these problems, but we're just going to get out there and laugh about them.
You're actually about half and half now, though, right?
We are. We've picked up some Washington area performers. We just got so busy. I think it was Bill Clinton who kind of tipped the scales, and we had to hire some extra people. He gave us so much material.
Because of so much material coming out.
Right.
Yeah. So has anyone ever threatened to sue?
No, actually, we've been lucky. We fully expected a lot of that. We fully expected that, you know, not so much lawsuits as people would tell us, you know, hey, stop doing that song about me, or, you know, that's not fair. But the only complaint I ever got directly from a senator was a senator came up to me after a show, and he was upset that we didn't have a song about him. You know, it was like, you can't leave a politician out. That's the main thing.
Well, that may happen here too. You may have to make up a list of people that will require that you add a song by the time you do the second show in Anchorage.
All right. Well, maybe you'd like to come by and play one of Newt Gingrich's wives or something.
the new song about the three wives from an operetta. What was the song?
That's the Three Little Maids from School, and we have a practical problem with that song because Newt Gingrich has, as you know, three wives, and we only have two women in the show. So we have this debate every week as to who is the prettiest guy and who could play the third wife, and then he gets the dress and he's out there on stage. So I think you can decide when you see the show if we actually have pick the prettiest one or not.
Well, we have the chance to see the show. It's Thursday night at 7:30. It's at Centennial Hall. The Juno Arts Council says that the pre-sales are sold out, but because there were some blocks of seats that were set aside for legislators primarily, and some of them may be back home visiting their constituents on Thursday, it's conceivable that there will be some seats available at the door. Elaine, any last comments to brace us for the onslaught of Capital Steps as they hit Alaska?
Well, I mean, if you've ever wanted to see Joe Biden sing a rock song and Barack Obama sing a show tune and Newt Gingrich do classical ballet, this would be the place to see it. And I don't think you can see it anywhere else.
I can't imagine another venue where those things would be possible. Thank you so much. We're really looking forward to the show as it comes to Juno.
Thanks for having us on.
You bet. Bye.
Hi, I'm Herman Cain. And as you know, I've had to recently suspend my presidential campaign in light of recent allegations. But hey, at least I kept things interesting for a while. Much like in every movie, things are always more interesting when the pizza delivery guy arrives. So what's next? Though I once led it seems my race is through. So what is next for Herman Cain to do? I'll be CEO of a company that's mine, marketing a product called Love Potion Number 999. I'll sell it far and wide in distant lands. They'll buy it in Uzbekistan. You ladies know that you'll soon be feeling fine. Get yourself some potion for $9.99. Next time you have an interview, put some in your tea. You won't mind if the boss man puts his hand on your knee. Whatever he suggests, you will be glad to agree. You know that you will get a job,
and so will he.
Although it's true that recently I've learned her ass really is just one word, I began to realize that the White House won't be mine, cause my approval ratings are 0.99999. Love potion number 9999999.
$12.99. 20 after 3, you're in tune with KTOO News, and we're getting set for the Capitol steps to hit Juneau. They'll be here Thursday night, showing at the Centennial Hall. Tickets are a pre-show sellout, but there may be tickets at the door, so it's worth swinging by. Winter storm warning out from 6 p.m. this evening to 9 a.m. Wednesday morning. We're looking for a total accumulation of a foot of snow. Tonight we ought to get somewhere between 2 and 4 inches. We'll add 4 to 8 inches to that tomorrow or late tonight. And then Wednesday it'll snow in the morning and then it should turn around to rain. We'll get another 4 inches before it does. The highs will probably be rolling somewhere just a little above freezing, 33 to 35 for the 3 days. And the drop down will take us down to somewhere in the 15, 20 or the 20 degree temperatures at night. All the way through this, we're expecting east winds 10 to 20 miles per hour, 10 to 15 miles per hour on tonight, and then slowing down to around 10 miles per hour on Wednesday and shifting around to the south in the afternoon. So the change in the weather pattern comes on Wednesday. Until then, expect it to get snowy and snowy and snowy, and keep the driveway clear and keep cleaning it off the roof if you have one of those roofs that has to be cleaned down. We will be airing the president's State of the Union speech and the Republican response starting tonight at 5 o'clock. That will preempt the second hour of All Things Considered tonight. I have two guests in the studio with me who are going to talk to us about a wonderful program called Girls on the Run. Carrie Dixon and Addie Nacia are here from AWARE, and they're going to clue us in on this thing. I'm told that this is Carrie's premier performance as the spokesperson for Girls on the Run. Carrie?
Yeah, this is my first time to get to talk about Girls on the Run on the radio, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, tell me about the program. What is Girls on the Run?
Girls on the Run is a fun and empowering after-school program for 3rd through 8th grade girls. It really gives the girls an opportunity to go through a 12-week, 24-lesson curriculum. The program combines running with the strong curriculum that helps them make healthy life choices.
In what areas? Healthy life choices?
We touch on several different areas. At the beginning of the season, the curriculum really starts out focusing on the girl and the way that she can really make better life choices, like healthy eating, exercising. And then we move to the middle of the season where it focuses more on the team, communication, cooperation, partnership with others. And then we move to the end of the season where it's more focused on the community. And they do a community service project and really try to talk about and figure out ways that they can make a difference in their community. Girls on the Run is a program of AWARE. AWARE provides services to women and children who have been subjected to domestic violence and sexual assault, and we also work with community partners to prevent violence. Girls on the Run is one of AWARE's prevention programs, working to empower and strengthen women and girls to make healthy life choices and reach for their dreams.
Is AWARE a local organization, state, national?
Yes, AWARE's local organization here in Juneau.
So this was started when? How long has AWARE been part of Juneau's area? Hey, get some help from the old pro.
AWARE has been providing comprehensive services for victims of violence for about 30 years. Mm-hmm. And AWARE is a member program of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. And so there's similar programs to AWARE throughout the state of Alaska and also throughout the nation. And this movement of primary prevention is a really new movement that's landed in domestic violence sexual assault shelters that takes public health models of you know, the concepts and ideas around how to prevent and applies it to the issues of intimate partner violence and sexual violence. And Girls on the Run is new in Southeast Alaska, just started a couple of years ago, and it's modeled off of an international program that started in 1996.
Started internationally in another country? Or?
It started down south,
So
not kind of international.
But
North Carolina is where the program began.
Do you know who started it? Do you know what the inspiration was? Who inspired it?
Molly Barker actually started the program. She's a triathlete. She found that running really empowered her to be able to be a strong woman and make healthy life choices and really break out of that girl box that society puts you in. So she thought, hey, this would be a great thing to share with other girls, combining this running with this strong curriculum that focuses on healthy life choices.
Carrie, there's just a little hint of something in your voice that says that you may be familiar with Carrie, with Barker. Are you from the South?
Yeah.
I know you're from the South, but from where?
I'm from Arkansas.
Oh, from Arkansas. What brought you to Juneau?
I'm actually an AmeriCorps member here this year through the Saga Connections program.
And is this your first AmeriCorps assignment? Have you been other places?
No, I did an AmeriCorps term last year in AmeriCorps NCCC in California.
Oh, okay. So what do you think of Juneau compared to your other experience?
It's pretty cold and it's pretty snowy, but I like it.
Hey, and we've got, you think you've seen snow already. We got snow coming for you here. This is going to be quite a little interesting storm for us here in town. So do you have, are you into any winter sports?
Not really. I've done a little bit of skiing, but I'm not great at it, so.
Well, this is also a wonderful place to pursue that that pastime as well.
Definitely.
How did you come to be involved with this Girls on the Run program?
So through my AmeriCorps term, I was hired by AWARE to do my service there. And the Girls on the Run program was something that I was really interested in, just because I have a strong love for running, and it really taught me how to break out of that girl box and find who I really was and find confidence. And so when I found out that that was an AWARE program, I talked to Aussie, and it really worked out where I get to work hand in hand with the program. It's been awesome.
If someone wants to participate in this program, it's not only limited to people who are to women who are staying in the AWARE shelter or something like that, right? This is for everyone?
No. The program is offered to any third through eighth grader in Juneau. We're actually having programs in every elementary school and middle school here in Juneau. And so we welcome all third through eighth graders at those schools to apply for the program. And then we also have coaches, all women throughout Juneau, who volunteer to coach.
Now, do you is there a charge for participation in the program?
Girls on the Run does have a $100 charge, but on our application, there are two boxes, one for a full scholarship and one for a half scholarship. And no questions asked. If you check one of those boxes, you either get a full or a half scholarship, whatever your need is.
And that's is there any discount if there's more than one child in a family or anything like that?
If they check the box, there is, but otherwise, no.
No, okay. So it's $100 per child if you're paying the field, but there's also a scholarship program.
Yes.
If someone wants to participate in this, first of all, what's the time commitment for the girl? When does this take place?
A youth to participate, they would meet after school each day. In elementary schools, the program runs from about 2:30 to 4 o'clock, and it's twice a week, so usually Tuesday and Thursday. And then if they're in a middle school, it's from 3:30 to 4:15 usually.
And once a child is, you said they can apply for the program. Is there some acceptance process? In other words, does everybody who apply get in, or is there?
We really look at the number of coaches that we have and what's available, but we try to meet the need of every girl who applies getting into the program.
So once the child is in, then each Tuesday and Thursday afternoon they'd have to come to school ready to participate in the program after school in the afternoon?
Yes. And the program would run from the week of February 6th until the first week in May. We end with a 5K on May 5th.
If your child is in the program, then do you have some adult involvement? Are parents involved in the support for the program?
We encourage parents to be involved. Yes, we have. When the child applies, their parent gets a parent's guide that follows along with the curriculum, really something that we talk to parents about using at night at home, asking their kids questions about what goes on in the practices, and then we invite them to come to the 5K and participate and run with their child.
And the 5K date again was?
May 5th.
And it's that will be limited to participants in the program?
No, we welcome all community members, all coaches who have coached. We really like for that to be a community event. It's a huge celebration and a lot of fun and really empowers the girls and makes them feel confident and good about what they've achieved. And so we love for as many people to come as can be there. It's going to be at Twin Lakes.
So do you have the route all figured out as far as what it's going to be?
Yes.
Where will you run? Where will it go?
It's a little bit of an exciting type of a maze. So our race director has set up. Basically, the girls run out.
This is Audie speaking.
This is, yeah. So they run out about a half a mile, and then they come back, and we use some of the grassy field and set up cones. So there's a beautiful route that's really fun, and it keeps the girls close so that parents, community supporters, friends, and family can have signs and cheer and support the girls in this huge accomplishment of going through this comprehensive program that really addresses exploring yourself and becoming strong and empowered in being the best that you can be in serving your community. So
let's go through the process again. If someone is interested in having their child participate in this, they should be doing what at this point?
There are recruitment packets at every elementary school and middle school right now in Juneau. And so their child will see a presentation at school about Girls on the Run, and then they will have the opportunity to take that packet home, and their parents will see it, fill it out.
And this will come home in the take-home packet that they bring home from the school?
Yeah, the school counselors have the packets, and we'll do the presentations at the school.
Okay, and then once the sign-up happens, the first session of the Girls on the Run program is?
Is the week of February 6th. And so most schools, it'll be on Tuesday, February 7th.
Okay, and then the actual 5K is, again, the date?
May 5th.
So mm-hmm. From February 7th to May 5th is the length of the program, and it's probably two nights a week.
Yes.
Cost, again, is $100, but there's scholarship assistance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Jeff cued me in that there's something you guys have been doing at the end of each one of these interviews. Are you ready?
Could you say one more thing?
Yeah.
So one of the big things that we're looking for right now is coaches. We need different kinds of women to come out and coach with us. We, as many types of girls as there are in Juneau, we would like to have that much diversity in coaches. So not all of our coaches are runners. They can be from any walk of life. Really, we would love to have runners, non-runners, anybody who's willing to really empower girls to come out to our coach training. It's going to be this Saturday from 8 to 5:30. And it's at the Shrine of St. Therese, and we ask that if you're interested in coming to the coach training that you call us at AWARE. The number is 586-6610, or contact me at Carrie, KERID, at awareak.org.
Okay. There's a consultation going on here. They're setting something up, folks. Let's see what's going to happen here.
Girls on the Run is so much fun! Woo-hoo!
Thank you very much for sharing this with us today.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 24th of January, 2012. It's the birthday of Edith Wharton, the novelist, born in New York City, Edith Newbold Jones, 1862, the Joneses' wealthy New York society family. It's where the expression keeping up with the Joneses comes from. They were alarmed by their little girl, who was precocious, who taught herself to read, wrote her first novel on brown wrapping paper when she was 11 years old. When she was 14, she wrote her second novel called Fast and Loose, a parody of British romances. When she was 18, five of her poems were published anonymously in the Atlantic Monthly. Then, at the age of 18, she stopped writing for almost 10 years, lived the life of a rich young lady, first as a debutante, then as a young wife married to Teddy Wharton, wealthy man who had almost nothing in common with her. She loved motor cars, especially fast ones. She loved dogs, especially small dogs. She liked to knit. She was passionate about design. She loathed the Victorian style that she'd grown up with. It was cluttered and dark with heavy drapes and fancy upholstered furniture. And she loved to write. In 1905, she published The House of Mirth, the story of the socialite Lily Bart, raised as a proper young woman, no job skills, so, after her parents died, her only hope is to marry a rich man. She can't bring herself to marry someone she doesn't love, and because of this she ends up friendless and poor. It was a tragic story. It was the best-selling book of the year. She went on to write more popular novels, including Ethan Frome and The Age of Innocence. It was on this day, 1848, the California Gold Rush began. Carpenter and wheelwright James Marshall was leading a crew to build a sawmill for a man named John Sutter near Sacramento on the Sacramento River. He owned 50,000 acres along the river, and he wanted to start a logging operation. It was a cold, clear January morning, the night before Marshall had diverted the river so he could put in the sawmill, and on this morning he found gold flecks where the water had been. John Sutter asked the workers to keep the discovery a secret so he could go on and build his sawmill, but the story came out in the Californian in San Francisco in mid-March, and then in August in the New York Herald, and gold prospectors headed for California. Mark Twain headed for California, spent some time prospecting in Angel's Camp, trying to make his fortune, didn't find any gold. He did, however, hear a man tell a story about a frog and how they filled him with buckshot so he couldn't jump, and so he lost his owner a bet. And that story was the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County, the story that made Mark Twain famous. Here's a poem for today by Joyce Sutphen entitled Silo Solo. My father climbs into the silo. He has come, rung by rung, up the wooden trail that scales that tall belly of cement. It's winter, 20 below zero. He can hear the wind overhead. The silage beneath his boots is so frozen it has no smell. My father takes up a pickaxe and chops away a layer of silage. He works neatly counterclockwise under a yellow light, then lifts the chunks with a pitchfork and throws them down the chute. They break as they fall and rattle far below. His breath comes out in clouds. His fingers begin to ache, but he skims off another layer where the frost is forming and begins to sing, "You are my sunshine, my only sunshine." The poem Silo Solo, Joyce Sutphen, from her collection First Words, published by Red Dragonfly Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, helping small businesses use email marketing with social media to reach more customers in more places, online at constantcontact.com. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzer. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
It's 22 minutes to 4. You're in tune with KTOO FM. Tomorrow night on our PBS station here in town, we have a special program which is going to show a lot of Alaska footage. The program was put together by PBS Nature filmmakers who traveled up to Alaska and shot a thing called Fortress of the Bears for the PBS Nature series. But most of the action takes place at Pack Creek on Admiralty Island. And the chief person in charge of Pack Creek was here on the show the other day and had mentioned this show. We had a little trouble finding out exactly when it was going to air in the air schedule, but it will be on PBS television tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Alaska time on PBS, so please tune in. So my next two guests are two gentlemen from the Alaska State Museum, which is here in Juneau, and they are going to talk to us about a program which will start on Wednesday nights, and then Bob Banghart, who will be the first speaker in this, is with us to tell us a little bit of a preview about his show. So, Steve, you're the person who organized this this series, and you said that you had keyed it to the collections in the museum. Steve?
That's right. Thank you. The lecture series that we do every year this time of year is based on recent research done on the collections of the Alaska State Library Archives and Museums, and many of the presenters actually are staff at those institutions. And the series is named in honor of Andrew Kashavirov, who is our first full-time curator starting in 1919. He was also the priest at the St. Nicholas Orthodox Church and also a historian of Alaska a fairly well-versed in Alaska Native cultures as well. But we put together these lectures in his honor, and the first one will start tomorrow. These all take place during the noon hour, so it'd be good for people to get out and get some fresh air, walk over to the museum, and we'll start up the lectures about 10 minutes after 12, and they'll go about 40 minutes, so there's time to get to and from work, and you're welcome to bring lunches there and eat them during the presentation. But Bob is starting off tomorrow with his talk about the updating everyone on the status of the SLAM project.
And so, Bob, what is the SLAM project?
SLAM is the abbreviated version of State Library Archives and Museums, which connotates the new consolidated building, which currently the Division of Libraries, Archives, and Museums is existing between our current location of the State Museum, the Archives Building to the south of the parking garage of the State Office Building, and on the 8th floor and 7th floor of the State Office Building. So this brings the entirety of the division under one roof for the first time.
And under a new roof.
Under a brand new roof, considerably larger roof, yes.
So of what we know now of as the State Museum Building, what of that will continue to be where it is and like that? How does this fit into that?
Well, nothing of that building will remain after the new building is installed. The new building, if you can envision the current parking lot between the Prospector Hotel and the museum, the back lot, which was formerly the Delta Western Tank Farm, and the current site of the museum, all will be enveloped into the new building site. It's a 118,000-square-foot building. It's about 3.5 times bigger than what you're seeing there currently. It's a very large piece of work.
When will this building be sitting in that place so we can walk through the front door?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, or let's say that's the $94.5 million question. the current status is we've got a little over $32 million in the bank that's dedicated to the project. The governor was very gracious in a $20 million request in his budget that came forward in December. That left us with about, that has to be approved by the legislature. So we're looking at about another $74 million of monies on the table before we'd have actual construction funding in hand. That said, we're working with the legislative delegation, the legislature, our division, the commissioner, and everyone to see, what could be the most accelerated construction time for this project. In an optimum circumstances to take advantage of the favorable building climate and the cost of commodities today, we would start this summer, and the building process is approximately 30 months long. That remains to be seen. We still need the support of the legislature. We're a state agency. We support state activities. The bulk of our work, though people may feel it's here, it's not. We service agencies around the state, other libraries, archives, and museums, and we put a lot of resources and efforts into that. So we are mandated to serve a statewide constituency. So we do have a pretty good support base in that respect from legislators from around the state.
So what is the next step in the process?
Well, the next step in the process, is we have to finish our construction documents. Those will be completed in April of this year. Then we could apply that oft-used term, shovel-ready, to the project, and we could look forward to a building schedule set to our budget structure. So the current methodology for dealing with building the new building entails building the vault areas. This is the collection storage area for both archives and museums, and that would be on the back Delta Western lot. Then we would bridge over through a secured union between the new vault and the existing building, and we would evacuate the building from its permanent collection storage to its new permanent collection storage. So there's no interim location. And then once completed, we would then close the museum, the building would come down, and then we would commence construction of the new facility, joining it with the vault area and then backfilling the interior exhibit spaces, etc. So about a 36-month from the first shovel in the ground from the excavators to final at the current and opening.
And out of that 36 months, how long would the museum not be open?
We're right now looking at about 22 months, where we would be not open to the public, is our current estimate. Now, this is what's called a CMGC project, Construction Managed General Contractor. At 20% of our construction design documents, we brought in a general contractor, and they have been walking with us through every facet of design to both define buildability and also to help us rectify costs. Each time we go through a major phase, they come in and they justify our costs to make sure we can stay on budget. It's been really, really helpful. And in line with that, they've also been helping us calibrate just exactly how much time and what processes we could employ to safely move the collection and get us back online as quick as possible.
Is there anything that lovers of the museum can do to help this process along?
Well, the lovers of the museums, libraries, or archives can make contact with the legislative delegation and say, we support this, this is a good thing. Yeah, just make their voice heard to the legislature, to the governor's office, saying, this is important for the state of Alaska. It's important for Juneau as the capital. It's important to them as supporters of the institution.
And, Bob, you're going to give a larger presentation kind of around this same stuff that we've talked about. That'll be tomorrow night?
Tomorrow at noon. We'll start about 12:10. Yes, and I've got I've got some images that give people an indication as to some of the visuals of the building, some of the visuals of the interior, and just talk about some of the relationships, where we're going. This will just be a precursor to a February 2nd public meeting at the museum at 7 o'clock, where we will have the design team and others from the whole project in with a very exhaustive presentation with a lot of new images that staff have not yet seen on what the vision for the project is. So We're looking forward to seeing that, because I think it's going to be pretty exciting.
Again, that was February 2nd at 7 p.m.?
Yes, that's the full-on thing. This is a precursor to that.
And open to the public?
Absolutely open to the public, yeah. The PR is going out on that now.
And then, Steve, you're doing the next presentation in the sequence, which is Steve Hendrickson talking, Curator of Collections, talking about the Alaska Native treasures in the museum.
Yes, on February 1st, the following Wednesday, I'll be doing the presentation, and it's actually looking at a collection of Alaska Native material at the British Museum and comparing that to what's in the Alaska State Museum and how the two collections complement each other. And, of course, that collection is really encyclopedic in its coverage, and in addition to having materials from all over the world, has some of the earliest artifacts collected from Alaska by people like Captain Cook and George Vancouver and Kotzebue and other collectors and explorers from the late 1700s, early 1800s. And this kind of material doesn't exist in Alaska anymore, and it barely exists in North America. I mean, the Smithsonian has some early collections too, but really this is unprecedented material. And even though we don't have much material of that age in our own collection, we have more recent material. And looking at both collections gives you a sense of how the culture's evolved over a couple hundred years of history. And it actually, the two really work together well. So I'll be showing photographs of some premier Tlingit, Haida, and Aleut and Yupik material that they have in the museum there. A lot of it's never been published, and it'll be kind of fun to look at those and talk about them. So that's what I've got lined up for a week from tomorrow. And then the next Wednesday, February 8th, Anastasia Tarman from the Alaska State Library Historical Collections is doing a presentation on the last century of history in Cake, Alaska, and will involve some of the more famous episodes of their history, the burning of totem poles, the founding of the city of Cake, and they just had their centennial just a few weeks ago, actually, and some other little-known facets of their history that are documented in the documents and photographs at the State Library.
And then there are three more in the series to follow that. So these will be on Wednesdays at noon, and it starts with Bob Banghart giving us an overview of the SLAM project, the proposed renovation of the museum and rebuilding.
Not proposed, and,
well,
my friend.
Happening. Okay, it's happening. All right, okay, good enough. Well, thank you very much for bringing these programs to our attention. Folks can see can join you at the museum at 12:10, about 10 afternoon. Bring their lunch if they want to for each one of these programs. And then, Bob, you're having this public meeting on February 2nd at 7 p.m.
Correct.
Where folks will be able to see the new images of the museum as they're going to be. Thank you very much for coming down
and
sharing this with us.
This is Bird Note. Environmental conditions shape birds' bodies, even birds belonging to the same family. For example, consider the terns. The common terns you're hearing have long pointed bills they use to catch small fish. They migrate along both coasts and through the interior in spring and fall, on their way between nesting grounds in Canada and their winter home in the tropics. By migrating, they move from one warm and productive environment to another. Their close relative, Arctic terns, look much alike, but both their bills and legs are shorter. Both species feed in exactly the same way. So why would the Arctic tern's bill and legs be shorter? Well, because Arctic terns breed in the Arctic and winter in Antarctica, they're subject to much more severe weather than our common terns. Because birds' bills and legs are not covered by feathers, they lose heat. It just makes sense, then, for birds in cold climates to have short bills and legs, and less exposure to the cold. You can compare photos of the Arctic tern and the common tern, and learn more about both, on our website, birdnote.org. If you know someone who can't catch BirdNote at the time it's aired, let them know they can get BirdNote online or as a podcast any time, day or night. I'm Michael Stein.
Seven minutes to four, Pat Moore, your host on Juneau Afternoon. My next guests are two gentlemen representing the Juneau School District. Glenn Gulbrick is here. Administrative Services Director David Means has joined us. And we're talking about the news of the day, I think. Gentlemen, it's been recently released that the budget for the school district is going to be amazingly short this year.
Very true. At this point, based on the assumptions of the governor's budget and allocations for next year, we're projecting a $5.8 million shortfall in terms of continuing existing programs.
When you say a $5.8 million shortfall, that, in other words, the amount of money that you would have needed in order to continue things without change would have been $5.8 million more than you have?
For the most part, yes. There are a couple of things where we need to increase in investment, in particular instructional supplies and outdated technology are two areas that would have been added into the budget. But to continue forward at the same level of programming and to do those two things would be about $5.8 million more than what the current funding scenario suggests.
So now, unless something changes, as I understand it, we're going to lose a number of people who are currently working for the school district.
Yes, nearly 70.
And that cut goes clear across all aspects of the school system.
It does. The premise of developing the recommended budget that's before the budget committee now is to keep those cuts as far away from the classroom as possible. And so The smallest percentage reduction is in the classroom. Next smallest is extended support to the classroom. Then our administrative level, and then even greater cuts at the superintendent's cabinet level.
If I understand it, the real thing that causes the shortfall is the amount of the base student allocation. Is that a correct statement?
It's certainly a big part of the shortfall. We have a number of grants that are disappearing. We have one-time funding that was provided by the legislature last year that automatically goes away. We used a surplus in the ending fund balance last year that's no longer available because it's like a savings account. You can only spend it once. And those are the primary factors contributing to the deficit.
Can you explain the base student allocation? Can anyone?
Our time is limited. Fundamentally, there's a base student allocation, which is 5,600 something right now. And that gets plugged into a formula for a lot of factors, including cost of living factors statewide, including other multipliers that are in the formula. And that drives, it's the core element to what in the end is our funding level.
There's a series of meetings now which are going to go on. The first one, I believe, is tonight.
Tonight is actually the third meeting.
Oh, third. Yeah. Okay. But tonight is the first time that you'll be hearing public testimony. Is that correct?
That's correct. We had a meeting, which is basically an introductory meeting, before the end of last calendar year. We had a meeting last week in which we presented a recommended budget from the administrative staff. And the budget committee added questions, and tonight we will have public testimony at the beginning of the meeting, and then the committee has reserved some time for their discussion and deliberation. We'll have a follow-up meeting. That meeting is at Santa Kahini tonight. We'll have a follow-up meeting a week from tonight on the 31st of January. That will be at Juno Douglas High School. That will also be a meeting in which we take public testimony, and the committee has an opportunity to deliberate.
David Means, you're the administrative manager for the administrative services director. So how will your component be affected by the budget change, by this budget shortfall?
My component consists of a lot of staff support services to the district. And as Glenn mentioned, that's one of the areas we looked at very much so the reductions would be farther away from the classroom as possible. So that would mean that we're looking at fewer maintenance employees, fewer custodians employees, fewer people in the finance office. And those are just real positions that we're looking at that we're not going to be filling for next year.
But you'll
I think that's where I understand your question.
Well, but in addition to not filling them for next year, when you say that, you mean that there are actually people who are working in some of those positions
yes,
now who
very much
will
so.
Not have positions next
yes.
year. Yes. Do we have any kind of number for the total impact of eliminating 69 jobs in the school district?
Well, the impact to the school district is obvious
yes.
that it's mission-threatening. We asked the Juno Economic Development Council if there was a way for us to think about this in a broader sense, meaning for the community of Juno, what would this mean? And their estimate is that the negative impact to the community is about $11.5 million. By the time you take away this level of salaries and then the indirect ways in which this money moves through the local economy, they use a particular formula for estimating economic impact. They plug the numbers in. We ask them to do it because that's their area of expertise.
We only have a couple of minutes more. Can you reiterate the times that the public can attend the hearings that are coming up, or the meetings? I don't know what
sure.
you're calling them.
Yeah, they're basically budget committee meetings,
okay.
And the public can attend all of them. Public testimony will be taken this evening, 6 o'clock, Santa Kahini Middle School, a week from tonight, January 31st, also at 6 o'clock, and then again on Tuesday, February 21st. That also is at 6 o'clock and at Juno Douglas High School.
Well, it sounds like your job got a little less enjoyable than it normally is, Glenn. I can't imagine how it's going to be for delivering the news that you'll have to deliver, David. But is there any way out of this? I mean, what would it take? A massive change in the base student allocation?
Well, I think it takes a couple of factors. One is an increase in state funding. The other is for us to do everything we can to contain the costs of operating our school district. Our economy is we're not as destitute as the lower 48, but our economy isn't thriving, and so it's our job to try to hold the line as much as possible. So we're trying to do that. It's a big task.
Glenn Gelbert, David Means, thank you very much.
Well, thank you
for telling us the story.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you. This is KTOO FM Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on translators in the Valley and Auk Bay area. You can tune to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, we're on K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens at K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS at 89.9. In Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juno on digital channel 871, and KRNN can be heard on digital channel 872, and KXLL is on channel 873, and we're also online at www.ktoo.org.